DiscerningHearts.com presents Inside the Pages, insights from today's most compelling authors. I'm your host, Chris McGregor, and I'm delighted to be joined by Paul Sons, who earned a Master of Arts in Pastoral Ministry from the University of Portland. His writing has appeared in many publications, including Catholic World Report, National Catholic Register, Adoremos, Our Sunday Visitor, and Catholic Answers. He is the author of Fatima, 100 Questions and Answers About the Marian Apparitions. With Paul Sons, we go inside the pages of Church Councils, 100 Questions and Answers, published by Ignatius Press. Paul, thanks again for joining me. I'm so glad to have you here.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
It is such a wonderful book that you just came out with. I just want to make sure everybody sees it. Church Councils, 100 Questions and Answers. I think the most important question is, what's a council? And you address it right there in the book, because many of us don't realize that we've had some very important ones that have helped keep us on a wonderful path in our spiritual lives, especially in the church, when things just start hitting that bumper on the highway that, you know, shakes your car and says, okay, time to get back into the center.
That's right. Yeah. And these councils have come up at very important times in the church's history, because they typically happen when the church is facing some great need, sometimes maybe later than they should have, or sometimes they were trying to address a problem over the course of many years, but then unsuccessfully. And so then it ended up responding to a problem rather than getting ahead of it. But looking at the history of the ecumenical councils really is a fairly good kind of microcosm of the church's history so far.
And as a result, isn't it, of the great growth and expansion of the church that was at one time, believe it or not, contained in an upper room. And that's where the birth took place. But once they went out, would eventually reach all ends of the earth in a very real way, hasn't it?
That's right. And you can see that in the councils too, where some of the earlier councils would have a couple hundred bishops, maybe 150 bishops. It was kind of a smaller scale. And then you get to the Second Vatican Council, where there's thousands of bishops from truly all around the world, you know, every inhabited continent, and bishops and priests and advisors and press and from all around the world, representing this, you know, truly universal church that we have.
Addressing very important questions that would need to be addressed, given the fact that the church expanded into so many different cultures. And because of the space between these cultures, these cities, where the church had found a home and hearts that would receive it, in those cultures, those teachings, sometimes certain elements of the faith would begin to be misunderstood or communicated in ways that wasn't healthy for that faith life. Am I saying that properly, Paul?
Sure. I mean, you see that sometimes in the early church, where there was kind of a different theological vocabulary between the East and the West, you know, the Latins and the Greeks. Sometimes they'd almost be just talking around each other because they were coming from a little bit of a different place philosophically or culturally. And so trying to discern and address the questions about the person of Jesus Christ, or of the Trinity, or of the relationship of Mary to the church, or whatever it is, these things kind of need to be hashed out. Most of the time, these heretical or erroneous beliefs, teachings that were being spread that had to be addressed by these councils. I mean, Arius wasn't trying to mislead people nefariously. He thought one way, and he was mistaken. His teaching was erroneous, and that unfortunately spread wide and far. But there are important questions. Some people might see sometimes a problem these days from time to time, where people see theological details, nuance, or doctrinal details as secondary, because they try to focus too much on, you know, social teaching. They say, well, we don't need to worry about how many wills Jesus Christ had. We just need to be feeding the poor and housing the homeless and that kind of thing. Well, but these are not unrelated, for one thing. These are not unimportant questions. So these things really do need to get hashed out and clarified so that people are adhering to the truth. And that's what these councils, that's the purpose that these councils serve.
I think we learned an important lesson during the COVID lockdown where everybody had to stay where you were at. So you could take that back 1,500, 1,700 years ago, where people were located in different towns, different places. They couldn't necessarily get together. They couldn't get a Zoom meeting together to hash all these things out. It was complicated and difficult to try to get everyone together into one room.
Yeah.
And then to be able to have those conversations. And that's what these early councils, in a very real way, they were trying to accomplish, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, that's right. And because of the importance of gathering together and figuring these things out, that's one of the questions that's addressed in the book that I've heard a lot on these interviews and that I hadn't really thought of before was, why are the councils held where they are? The councils are held in various places, everywhere from Nicaea to Constantinople to Lyon to Florence to Trent to the Vatican and others. And the location for the different councils was something that was determined by the importance of being able to gather. So if sometimes it depended on what was being addressed at the council, because the folks involved, the people who were teaching this erroneous teaching, the people who were most involved in fighting that heresy, whatever it was, needed to be able to get to the council easily. And in many ways, long distance travel was not easy. One good example too is the Council of Trent. That location was chosen because this council was largely in response to the Protestant Reformation. And they thought, well, we'll have it in Trent because that will be easier for the Protestant reformers to get here so that we can hash these problems out. We can address their errors and hopefully resolve these issues. None of the reformers ended up going, but that is part of why that location was chosen, was because of the importance of gathering. Even still, even any future ecumenical councils we have will not be done over Zoom or over phone or over email. These councils will happen in person in some location that is logistically easy because it's important to be there in person together.
It is. And we have to go back to that first gathering of the church, the birth of the church, because we do believe with prayer, hopefully have to believe that those were occurring at these councils. There is prayer and that calling of the Holy Spirit to bring about unity. And sometimes in that unity, there was maybe some strong, passionate feelings and words and maybe a slap or two, but literally. But it's because they so sincerely believed that they were right.
Yeah.
And that's why they needed to come together as brothers and as believers to work out what it is that God's actually trying to bring the church to.
Right. Absolutely. And going forward, that's how it'll continue to be.
And some of those I alluded to, a slap. I thought it was wonderful, even in the book, that you addressed, did St. Nicholas really slap somebody?
Yeah, that's an interesting story that you hear from time to time. At the first ecumenical council, the Council of Nicaea, way back in 325, St. Nicholas was in attendance, as was Arius, the founder of these heretical teachings that the council was addressing. And there's this story that goes that St. Nicholas walked up to Arius at the council and slapped him across the face as punishment for his heresy. We don't know for sure if that happened. The story is from much later, and the point of it is not whether or not it happened, but it makes a point about St. Nicholas, that he was a faithful, devout, Orthodox shepherd who was the sort who would be upset by heresy and fight it, whether by words or, with an open hand.
I think it's important for us to understand these councils because who is it? Was it Cicero that said that the person who doesn't know their history is destined to remain a child forever? And these councils contain very important benchmarks for us, the light posts for us, as the church grew in a greater awareness of who we are and what is the Orthodox teaching and how we got there and why it's important. And that's why these councils are important to read. And I'm glad your book has brought this forward.
Thank you.
We'll return to Inside the Pages in just a moment. Did you know that Discerning Hearts has a free app in which you can find all your favorite Discerning Hearts programming? Father Timothy Gallagher, Dr. Anthony Lillis, Deacon James Keating, Mike Aquilina, Dr. Matthew Bunsen, and so many more are found on the Discerning Hearts free app. Did you also know that you can stream Discerning Hearts programming on numerous streaming platforms such as Apple Podcasts, Google Play, iHeartRadio, Pandora, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, and so many more? And did you know that Discerning Hearts also has the YouTube page? Be sure to check out all these different places where you can find Discerning Hearts. A prayer of St. Ignatius of Loyola.
Take, Lord, and receive all my liberty, my memory, my understanding, and my entire will, all that I have and call my own. You have given all to me. To you, Lord, I return it. Everything is yours. Do with it what you will. Give me only your love and your grace. That is enough for me. Amen.
Hello, my name is Deacon Omar Gutierrez, and I want to ask you to support Discerning Hearts in a special way. We, Chris McGregor, the board, and I all know that not everyone listening can help financially. We know we have listeners from all parts of the world, and we have made a commitment since the beginning to make the truths shared through Discerning Hearts totally free. So while you may not be able to contribute financially, what you can do is certainly pray, but also give us positive reviews on whatever platform you use to listen to us. If it's iTunes, Android, Stitcher, Spotify, however it is that you get these podcasts, or if you're on YouTube and you like our videos, please give us a good rating and write a review. The more good ratings and reviews we get, the higher our profile, and the more listeners will discover us, listeners who may have the means to contribute in the future. Please consider rating us and writing a positive review today.
We now return to Inside the Pages. We're talking with Paul Sens, the author of Church Councils, 100 Questions and Answers.
In the book, Paul, you talk about pre-councils and different types of gatherings that don't necessarily bear the same type of weight. Could you talk about those?
Yeah, so there were some gatherings of the church prior to the first Council of Nicaea, the first ecumenical council, that are not considered ecumenical councils, the most famous of which would certainly be the so-called Council of Jerusalem that we read about in the Acts of the Apostles. Mm-hmm. The main difference between that and the later ecumenical councils would be that the Council of Jerusalem was the council of the apostles themselves, whereas the ecumenical councils that would come centuries later and ongoing until today are gatherings of the successors to the apostles, the bishops. You know, we know that the bishops are the successors to the apostles, but they are not themselves apostles. So the Council of Jerusalem that we read about in Acts, we do see the kind of nascent form of what would later be the ecumenical councils, all of the apostles gathering together in order to address this theological question that had arisen, this dispute that had arisen, specifically about whether or not Gentiles were required to adhere to the Jewish laws when they became Christians. And there were kind of two camps developed, yes and no. You know, they gathered together, they prayed, they debated, they fought, but ultimately the final say came from the authority of Peter, which we still see with the ecumenical councils. The final say of the council, something that makes the council ecumenical, is if the Holy Father promulgates its teaching for the universal church. We see that in the kind of pre-ecumenical council at Jerusalem, and then that's how it has continued on down through the centuries. As far as different gatherings you asked about as well, when you hear the word council in different contexts, you know, parish council, finance council, presbyteral council, things like that. But the ecumenical council is usually what you talk about when you talk about mm-hmm. the church councils and down throughout the history, like we're talking about. And then, of course, we hear more and more about the Synod of Bishops, which is a very different a very different kind of a thing as well, because whereas the Ecumenical Council is all the bishops of the world together with the Pope teaching in unison for the universal church, the Synod of Bishops can be thought of more as like an advisory body to the Pope that meets periodically on a particular topic. You know, there might be a synod on the family, or a synod on synodality, or a synod on the church in Africa, or something like that. And bishops, theologians, others, a small group, maybe a couple hundred, will meet for a week or two, present papers, present thoughts, whatever, that they'll have particular questions they're working from. And then at the end, they present a kind of informational, maybe sometimes a recommendation or just point of reflection to the Pope. And usually, but not always, the Pope will then issue a document, a post-synodal apostolic exhortation, kind of reflecting and teaching on that topic. But it's a very different beast from the Ecumenical Council.
I'm glad you said it that way, because, again, as you said, advising the Pope, and then ultimately the Pope has the final say.
Right.
And even what he puts out is, as you said, the apostolic exhortation. That even doesn't bear the weight of an ecumenical council, because the ecumenical council is all the bishops and the Pope and, you know, the Church Universal. And sometimes even when synods gather, they offer the information to and their advice, and the Pope will come out with a document, but it may not necessarily be something that has a particular weight in the universal church. I mean, one apostolic exhortation may make a very strong statement about something, and the other one is wonderful guidance and reflection, but doesn't have that same type of impact on the life of the church. But would you say that's a fair explainer?
Yeah, that's right. And like I said, some of the topics that synods have met to address have been very kind of localized in nature. There was synods on the church in various parts of the world, synod on the church in Africa, the church in Europe, the church in Oceania, the church in Asia. You know, this is not something that's of fundamental import for the universal church. It's very interesting, and it is important for the church, but it's not something that is at the foundation of the church around the world.
They're fascinating. I think it was under St. John Paul II's reign as Pope, where he wrote these apostolic exhortations from those synods, and they're wonderful.
Yes.
The Church in the Americas, I think, is a must reading for anybody in North America, South America, and like you said, around the rest of the world. But there's something about those ecumenical councils. And when you go back to that very first Council of Nicaea, for example, and again, we're talking about that guy, Arius, and the Arian heresy, it ultimately comes down as defining who we are and what we believe.
Yeah.
And knowing our identity, knowing what we believe. And that's how this profession, this creed, our credo, is a statement of that. And that even developed over time. It took us several councils, many years, before we really began to understand all of that. And those early councils are important, aren't they, Paul?
That's right. Yeah, those earliest councils that were really hashing out and discerning some of the most fundamental aspects of our faith, trying to, I wouldn't even say wrap our heads around, but trying to figure out how to think about and how to maybe start understanding the Trinity and the person of Jesus Christ and the theology of the church and the Holy Spirit and Mary and her relation to the universal church, and that some of these things that are just really at the heart of Christian faith.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up the Marian relationship to the church. I mean, into understanding about Mary, oftentimes in the councils, what we're finding is because we understand Mary a certain way, it tells us not as much about her as what it tells us about who Christ is.
That's right.
And then on the same flip, it could be more about who we are as well. And I think that's why it's so important to enter into the writings of those councils.
Yes, everything that the church teaches about Mary, the reason we care about Mary is not because of who she is, but because of who Jesus Christ is, as you say. And so that's what those councils were addressing, was who is Jesus Christ And one of the ways that that was discerned was, who is his mother in relation to him? Is she the mother of merely of the human Jesus of Nazareth? Well, if he is fully man and fully God, then she's the mother of God, because one person, you're not the mother of a nature, you're the mother of a person. So it's really about Jesus Christ, which is what Mary wants anyway.
I have to say, there is someone who's written some beautiful reflections on this, Mike Aquilina, who wrote the foreword for your book. And I think it's important. I probably should have done this right off the bat, because there are going to be people sitting and listening going, who was this Arius guy? Unfortunately, in a very real way, Arianism, even though Arius may have, who knows, by the time he may have felt fraternally corrected and maybe changed his thought, unfortunately, the thought got out there. And maybe you could, in a nutshell, just explain what Arianism is and how, unfortunately, we can still see it today, can't we?
The main thing about Arianism, he taught that Jesus was not divine, but was a creature. You might say that Arius taught that he was made, not begotten, not consubstantial with the Father. And so this is something that obviously is not the Orthodox Christian faith. So that had to be corrected. He taught that Jesus was the greatest creature, the most important creature that God had made, but still a creature. And that's certainly something that we see various maybe species of today, where people try to neuter Jesus basically and make him more approachable or something like that. But really, it's still problematic, because they're denying or downplaying at best the divinity of Jesus Christ. They tried to say he was just a great moral teacher, or he was some kind of a guru, or he was some kind of a philosophical, merely a philosophical master or something like that. You know, there's that old song, "What if God was one of us?" My wife and I always joke about that and say, well, he is. Jesus was fully God and fully man. You know, this is not something to downplay. And it's important for everything, for his salvific redemption of us and his relationship to us, our relationship to him. Arianism in various forms is still alive and well. But because of these ecumenical councils, and the church is teaching and protecting from error, we know better, and we can fight against those tendencies and do our best to teach the truth.
I'm glad you said that, because words matter. Words matter. They bear the weight of what it contains. And why is that important? When you begin to tweak the words, or you begin to change things, or because of the diverse size of the church, translations matter. How we celebrate things matter. All those have to be brought gently, because as I said in the very beginning, you're driving down the road and then you begin to hit those bumpers on the side, because it's very easy to go sliding way off track. I think we see it today too, Paul, in modern depictions of maybe the life of Jesus or in other stories, where we emphasize the humanity of Jesus, which was beautiful and glorious, sacred humanity, but at the cost, though, unfortunately, sometimes in those betrayals, of his sacred divinity and of who he was as God. But sometimes it's so much easier to say, boy, he's more relatable here as this human person. Look at him, and he understands. Well, yeah, he does. But it's also because of his divine nature. Do you think I'm being too picky here?
Well, no, I think that's true, because if we say it's so wonderful that Jesus was relatable as a human, well, yeah, there have been billions of humans who can relate to humanity, but what makes it important is that he was also fully God. It's denying or ignoring or downplaying that kind of defeats the purpose. Well, who cares if he could relate to being human? There are billions and billions of people who can relate to being human. What makes it special is that divinity.
And that's what these councils, in a very real way, have to grapple with throughout time. And I mean, as you were looking at all the different ecumenical councils that we've had, whether it was that Nicene Council pulled together by Constantine, or the one that was called for even shortly ago, even though it was over 50 years, but the Second Council by Pope John the 23rd, which one would you say is the most intriguing, or the one that people should really get to know, just from your own experience, maybe the ones that maybe have surprised you, Paul?
Yeah, the most impactful councils are probably the ones that people hear about the most and know about the most. First Council of Nicaea, Council of Ephesus, Council of Trent, First and Second Vatican Councils. These were probably some of the ones that had the greatest impact on the Universal Church. And I think it's appropriate that those are the ones that people hear the most about. But there have been 21 ecumenical councils so far, all of which have been important, all of which have been influential in some way, and all of which are very interesting. And I hope that some of that interesting quality comes out in the book when I talk about each council. And I hope that folks will read the book and that it will prompt them to delve deeper into those councils that interest them the most.
Yeah, I mean, there is something very important about the Second Lateran Council, but I'm not going to tell you what, because I want you to go get the book. The Church Council's 100 Questions and Answers. Once again, just as you did with your Fatima book, this one is so intriguing and makes us want to go and seek the more. I wish we had more time, Paul. Any final thoughts that you'd like to share with our audience?
Remember that don't take the councils at face value. Really, don't be afraid to dive more deeply into them. The book is very simple and kind of superficial in nature. It's a very, very much an introductory kind of approach. So whatever interests you, there's plenty of information out there for each council, some more than others. Some of the councils are kind of hard to find a lot of details about, but don't be afraid to dive right in.
Yeah, I'm glad you said it that way, because sometimes people will maybe have this thought in their head that, well, I'm not that deep. I don't want to go that deep. Actually, these writings are very beautiful. And it is wonderful reflection when we race out and we look for spirituality books all over the place. And yet here are some of the richest, most beautiful spiritual material that you could ever want. And it's right here at our fingertips.
Right. Absolutely right.
Paul, I am so grateful that you've been with us. Thank you so very much.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
With Paul Sens, we've gone inside the pages of Church Councils, 100 Questions and Answers. To learn more about this book or to obtain a copy, go to Ignatius.com, the website for its publisher, Ignatius Press, or you can find it at any fine Catholic bookstore. To hear and or to download this conversation along with hundreds of other spiritual formation programs, visit discerninghearts.com, or you can find it within the free Discerning Hearts app or on whatever streaming platform you find your podcasts. This has been a production of Discerning Hearts. I'm your host, Chris McGregor. We hope that if this program has been helpful for you, that you will first pray for our mission, which is to offer authentic and rock-solid spiritual formation freely to souls around the world. And if you feel us worthy, please consider a charitable donation to help support our efforts. But most of all, we hope that you will tell a friend about discerninghearts.com and join us next time for Inside the Pages, Insights from Today's Most Compelling Authors.